Okay. As you know, I'm a little bit preoccupied with Baruch Hashem preparations for Simcha, so I apologize. Thank you. I apologize that I did not have a chance to prepare a source sheet. But I wanted to talk today about an inyan that a number of you have been asking me to talk about, so I thought we can at least begin the conversation from a Beis Din perspective, and that is the question, thank you very much, of the degree to which a Beis Din can take into account circumstantial evidence, umdanus, as we might say, to decide a case according to umdanus, according to what we call omin hadas, where, let's say, you don't have all of the ideal forms of testimony and evidence of two kosher witnesses who are testifying about somebody's claim in front of the Beis Din, that's usually not the case. Usually, when an act of damage occurs, you don't have one person assault somebody else or somebody commits a tort against somebody else. You don't have two kosher witnesses that are standing around, you know, waiting to be able to witness the action and testify in front of a Beis Din. And sometimes you even have claims that are made by one party to another where there isn't a clear-cut promissory note, where there isn't a clear-cut kosher shtar that serves as the basis for a claim. There might be some type of an oral agreement between parties, and the Beis Din has to really figure out whose claim and whose assertions have the greatest merit. And the question is, to what degree does a Beis Din have the authority to decide a case without Shnei Edim Ksherim, to decide a case on the basis of umdanus alone? Now, a related question that I sometimes get asked is the nature of the Beis Din's jurisdiction when it comes to deciding according to Pshara. Because we say that there's strict din, that there's the notion of the Beis Din deciding according to the strict letter of the law, and then there's the notion of deciding according to Pshara, according to principles of equity and fairness and what we might describe as yosher, what is the equitable result under the circumstances. Now, when you decide a case according to Pshara, so that also indicates that there's a little bit of flexibility for the Beis Din, that it doesn't necessarily have to start decide according to the strict letter of the law substantively, but that presumably also cuts into the procedural field as well. That it means that the procedural rules of evidence could perhaps be relaxed a little bit when a Beis Din is deciding according to Pshara. Now, it's important not to confusing to conflate these two different concepts in terms, because of the concept of umdana is different from the concept of pshara. I could say that a Beis Din is perhaps authorized to decide a case according to umdanus, according to circumstantial evidence, but still require that I have shnei edim, you know, ksherim that are going to provide the Beis Din with the circumstantial evidence, for example, you know. Or I could say that maybe umdana is a chelek of din, that there are certain cases where Beis Din is authorized to decide according to umdana, but that becomes the letter of the law. It's not necessarily pshara per se. It's not that the Beis Din is bending the law. It could be that maybe with respect to certain cases, I say that a Beis Din could take into account what are the more likely than not inferences to be made from the cumulative evidence that is offered, and that's not pshara per se, maybe that's ikar adin. So it's important not to necessarily to make both of these concepts into one concept, but at the same time, not surprisingly, there is some overlap with respect to these two different concepts, that the notion of Beis Din having pshara jurisdiction provides for more of an allowance for a Beis Din to decide according to umdanus, according to circumstantial evidence, rather than the strict letter of the law. So let me just provide a bit of an overview in terms of the basic sources that we find in halacha with respect to the concepts of Umdana, and then maybe we can relate it to Pshara, and we can relate it to what is the scope of Beis Din's flexibility nowadays when we have to decide a case that comes in front of us, and we don't have all of the bells and the whistles that would be, strictly speaking, required in order to be able to paskin according to strict din. What is the wiggle room that Beis Din, so to speak, has? Now, the Rishon that seems to be the most focused upon this notion and this discussion is Rabbeinu Asher, is the Rosh. There are a couple of places where the Rosh has extensive discussions in his tshuvas about the parameters of Umdana jurisdiction by the Beis Din. One of the main places is Klal Kuf Zayin Siman Vav in the tshuvas of the Rosh. And in that tshuva, the Rosh, interestingly enough, does put together these two different concepts. He does combine them. The notion that in order for a Beis Din to be able to properly function and to be able to decide cases correctly and responsibly, Beis Din has to be able to sometimes decide based on circumstantial evidence, and Beis Din has to be able to sometimes bend the strict letter of the law to issue a judgment based on the equitable considerations of the case rather than strict din. So the Brush in this particular tshuva does combine the two concepts. Otherwise, we don't find them combined necessarily so much. So the classical case of Umdana, where the Gemara says that no matter how compelling the circumstances are, you can't decide a case according to Umdana, is the case that describes Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. This is in Shavuos Daf Lamed Daled. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach, Era ben Nechama, Imlori Isi Echad Shiratzach HaKaveru L'Chorba. He says that I have to tell you that I feel bad on some level that I'm not able to convict a party who clearly appears to have committed an act of murder, but I have to tell you what happened, that I saw one perpetrator run after his intended victim into a desolate area, and I tried to stop the person, and I found that he's holding a knife, he's holding a sword, and there is a blood which is dripping out of the sword, and the victim is lying on the ground. When I discovered the victim inside of the ruins and the blood is spilling out of him, Amarti lo Rasha. So I turned to the perpetrator who's holding the sword that's dripping with blood, and he's probably standing there and laughing or something like that as well. And he said to this suspect, he said, Rasha mi hargo lezeh ani o ata. So the only two people who are around here who could have killed this victim is either you or me. And I certainly know that it wasn't me. But nonetheless, there's nothing I can do about it because I don't have the ability to carry out the judgment based on my own inferences. Because the Torah says you can only put somebody to death if you have two kosher witnesses. You don't have two kosher witnesses, so then you're not able to do it. That's the end of the story. So at the very least, we see that you're not able to utilize circumstantial evidence for a capital case, for Dine Nefashos. Now, what about Dine Mamonos? So the Mishnah in Sanhedrin indicates that we are Ma'ayim as the Eidim. We intimidate the witnesses when they come to testify in a capital case to make it clear to them that this is serious business, that they had better only testify about what they had actually seen. And we say to the witnesses, you should understand that you're not allowed to testify based on omit alone, based on your deductions or inferences or even strong circumstantial evidence. That's not considered to be good enough. That's consistent with this Gemara about Shimon ben Shetach. So the Gemara says, it seems like our Mishnah is implying that circumstantial evidence is not acceptable for capital cases, but it would be acceptable for monetary cases. That would seem to support the opinion of whom? Of Rabbi Acha. Rabbi Acha? Who's Rabbi Acha? Rabbi Acha, we have a machlokis between Rabbi Acha and the Chachamim, also brought in the Gemara here in Shavuos, also in Sanhedrin. What's the machlokis? I have a camel that's in heat. I've never seen a camel in heat. So I don't know exactly what it looks like, but apparently it's a scary sight. You see a wild camel, it's acting up, it seems like it's going a little bit crazy, and while it's acting up and acting a little bit crazy, you don't see exactly what happens, but you come back and you look at the scene a few minutes later, and there is a camel with a gaping wound on its side, and it's dead. It's not this camel, and you're trying to figure out which is the camel that perpetrated this murder. because that's going to be a nezik that occurred, and the owner of the camel that perpetrated the murder is going to be liable to pay the owner of the camel that was killed. So the reasonable deduction to make is that the camel that was in heat, the camel that was all excited and all wild and acting crazy, that this was the one that perpetrated the murder. That's what we call gamal ha'ocher bein ha'gemolin. Camel that's act is going crazy among the other camels. But nonetheless, since no witness actually witnessed this murder committed by this camel, there were no witnesses that are able to testify that this camel carried it out, so therefore we can't say with 100% certainty that this camel was the perpetrator, and therefore its owner is going to be liable for the death that occurred, for the damage that occurred. So it's a question then. Is the very strong circumstantial evidence that it must have been this camel that carried out the offense good enough, or is it not good enough? So Rabbi Acha says, "Gamal ha'okeh ben ha'gemalim and imsa gamal harug b'tzidu b'yadua shezeh hargo." Said that it's clear, it's unambiguous that it must be that this camel was the offender, and we're allowed to impose a monetary fine, a monetary judgment on the basis of that deduction. The Chachamim disagree. So it would seem that since the Mishnah says that we only tell the witnesses, you can't testify based on circumstantial evidence in a capital case, that maybe they're holding like Rabbi Acha, that if it's a monetary case, it's okay. So the Gemara rejects, the Gemara in Sanhedrin rejects that inference, and the Gemara says, no, it's true the Mishnah talks about Dinei Nefashos, but the same thing that the Mishnah had in mind with Dinei Nefashos is also true with respect to Dinei Mamnus. There's no real distinction between Dinei Nefashos and Dinei Mamnus. How do we paskin halacha l'maisa? You look in the Shulchan Aruch, Siman Tov Ches, and it's the same thing in the Rambam. The halacha as paskin is like the Chachamim, meaning that we hold that not only is strong, and we're talking about strong circumstantial evidence, not only is strong circumstantial evidence not considered to be sufficient in the realm of Dinei Nefashos, but it's also not considered to be sufficient in the realm of Dinei Mamonis. Now, is this an absolute principle, or is this not an absolute principle? So here's where it gets a little bit murky.
And sufficient means even as a sniff, as it's an additional argument? In other words, it's not even listened
meaning
to?
If I don't have the two witnesses, it's not going to... That's what the simple meaning is, that if I don't have two witnesses who are going to come along and testify, that the Bezdin is not going to be able to paskin on that basis. Now, the only thing is that the Gemaras in other places don't seem to be 100% consistent with this idea. We do find that when it comes to many monetary determinations, we rely on different levels of umdana, different levels of assessment of what really must have been going on, even if it wasn't made explicit in terms of rendering monetary decisions. For example, you have a man who heard that his son had died, and he gave away all of his possessions to somebody else, the Gemara in Baba Basra, and then he discovers, lo and behold, his son is still alive. So he's allowed to say, well, I only gave away all my possessions because I thought that my son was dead. Now that I discovered he's alive, so then this bequest is an invalid bequest, and I want my money back. We say he can have his money back. So that seems to be making an umdana, relying upon just the relevant or surrounding circumstances of what happened when he gave the gift, that we know that he had this mindset that he didn't say, I'm only giving the gift based on the assumption that I have no son, but we say, it must be the case. So we're relying upon an umdana of sorts. Or, for example, a shkimira, a person is lying on his deathbed and he gives away all of his assets, and then it turns out that he recovers from his illness. So we say, if he gave away all of his assets, nobody in their right mind is going to give away all of their assets if they expect to live. It was only on the basis that he thought he was going to die, and then, lo and behold, miraculously he recovered. So we say he has the right to recover all of the assets, all of the monies that he gave away. These are different forms of umdanus. You have a woman who's getting married. She doesn't want, let's say it's a second marriage or something. So instead of entering into a lengthy prenuptial agreement to protect her assets, she figures out another way to protect her assets from her second husband in case things shouldn't work out. She doesn't want him to get all of her money. So she gives all of her assets to one of her children before she gets married. She doesn't really intend for the child to walk away and to buy a palatial mansion with the money. She just wants to hide the money so that it won't be in the possession of her new husband. That's called the shtar mavrechus, that she's trying to hide the assets. She's mavrechus, she's running away, causing the assets to be shielded from being taken over by somebody else. So we say that the child who received the assets is not allowed to utilize the assets, because it's understood that it was only being placed there as a protective haven, a safe harbor for the mother who is getting married. So these are all different examples where we seem to have a reliance upon a person's umdana in terms of determining a monetary disposition of a particular situation. So the Maharika comes along, and the Maharika in Shoresh Kuf Chaf Hei says that this is not a contradiction with respect to our general principle that we don't follow umdanus when it comes to monetary judgments, because these are two different, very different types of situations. One is a situation where we're making an umdana regarding the person's mental state. We know what happened. We know that a person gave away assets. However, we're making an umdana. What was their intention? What was their mental state? What was the commitment that they were making at that point in time when they gave away the assets? Were there any conditions that we can say, based on the circumstances that we know about, based on the circumstantial evidence that we know about, that would define what the nature of this gift or bequest happened to be? But it's not a question that I'm relying upon circumstantial evidence to figure out what actually happened. I'm relying on circumstantial evidence to figure out a person's state of mind. That's very, very different than relying on circumstantial evidence, circumstances, and the like, in order to determine what actually happened. In the case of the camel, I'm trying to figure out how did this camel that has the gaping wound and is lying on the down on the ground dead, how did this camel get killed? Who was it, and under what circumstances was the camel killed? So here I'm trying to figure out, I'm not trying to define the parameters of a person's das or machshava, I'm defining a maise. In order to define a maise, so that's where I say that I'm not allowed to rely on umdunus. That's the distinction that the Maharik draws. Now,
according to the Rush, though, all these cases are simply, according, he would say that these are cases of pshara. These were talking about the shara situation.
We're going to get to the rush. It's not get ahead. As I said, the rush sort of brings it all together. We're going to get to the rush in a little while. We're going to get to the rush.
Does the wife, potential wife, they have to tell her husband that's what she's doing?
No, absolutely not. She's not obligated to tell him. And once the assets have been put away, so he doesn't have any claim towards them anymore. She has the right to give gifts before she gets married. He wouldn't have a claim anymore. If she had to,
before she hides them, he still wouldn't have a claim to her money.
That's right. No, he wouldn't have. The one who would have the claim potentially is the one who received the money. It's not the husband, because all the monies had been divested before she married him. So he's not the one who would have the claim. It's the one that she gave the money to who would have the claim. So that's what you would have to be careful about. Right. Okay, I remember that before my grandfather was Nifter, so he was trying to do some estate planning, some tax planning. So one of the things that he mentioned at the time was, oh, maybe he'll take us a few $1,000s a year and give to each of the grandchildren, but not necessarily that we're going to use the money right away. So my grandfather mentioned this possibility to me. So I said to my grandfather, I said, you're welcome to give me $5,000 a year, but I'm going to spend it. And so he didn't do it.
I wonder why that was.
I said, I was very straight. It's okay, he was also very straight, Baruch Hashem. But we used to have these types of conversations. It was very good. He was testing me. So the question is, does that work across the board? There's a Gemara Baba Basra in Daf Nun Ches that talks about Rabbi Bono decided a case. There was a man who heard his wife saying to her daughter, she said, I think you should be more tznuah than I was in life, because I bore 10 children while I was married to your father, but only one of them was from your father. So you shouldn't be like me. So the husband overheard the statement, so he got all upset, and he wrote up in his tzavah that he wants all of his assets to go to his one child. It should go to the one child. But nobody knew which child was really his child. So then he died, and then the question was, which one should receive the assets? So Rabbi Bana said that you should figure out by having the children go and knock on his grave, and we'll look for some sort of a siman. When they're all going to knock on his grave, they should all take a stick and whack the grave and see the matzeva, and see what type of response they get. So of all of the children that went to the matzeva, there was one child that felt uncomfortable doing that. The child didn't go. So Rabbi Bana said, oh, that must be the child. That must be the real child. So therefore, he's the one who's going to receive all of the money. So the question was, oh, but this is a case where we're actually determining a maaseh, right? We're determining a maaseh. In other words, which one was the child that the mother really had with the husband, as opposed to having illicitly with another man? So that's not simply a determination of das, that's actually a maaseh, and we're relying upon umdunus. It must be that the one who didn't go was really the child. So the truth is that if you look at the way that the Rashbam understands that Gemara, the Rashbam says, it's not necessarily an indication of a maisa, of that it's really true that this was the child. You could say that it's indicative that this is the child that had the best midos, and therefore this is the one that the father would have given the money to. Now, you could say a child that had the best midos, that's indicative that it wasn't the mamzer, but you could also say, as the Rashbam says, it was really a shuda d'daini type of situation. What's shuda d'daini? Shuda d'daini means it's judicial discretion, that a judge has the right to say, oh, it's stands to reason that this child who had the best midos is the one that the father would have wanted to give all of his assets to. So that it's really, if you understand it that way, even this case is not really relying upon umdanus in order to determine a maisa, but rather is relying upon umdanus in order to determine das. Okay, that's what this... What?
Similar...
By Shlomo HaMelech. So this is another question, Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech is not necessarily halakhic precedent, because the Gemara in Makos indicates that there was some sort of a Ruach HaKodesh that Shlomo HaMelech had to decide his case. Nonetheless, the case of Shlomo HaMelech is used as a precedent, as we'll see. The Rosh quotes from the case of Shlomo HaMelech. We'll see the Vilna Gaon also quotes from this case of Shlomo HaMelech as well. But there, that's might you can also explain that maybe it's a raya against this proposition, because there he really had to determine which of the two mothers was the one who really was the, which of the two women was the real mother of the child that they were fighting over, the child that was alive as opposed to the child that died. Or you could say, no, really it's not something that ever could have been determined objectively, but it's a question of shuda d'daini, what's a fair and just under the circumstances, which is not necessarily determining a maisa either based on this notion of umdanus. So that's one approach. The approach of the Marik is one approach. Now, another approach that we find, there's a sometimes we see that we rely upon a person's credibility, even when, according to the strict letter of the law, that wouldn't be enough. What's an example? The Gemara in Daf Pehei talks about how there was somebody who was supposed to take a Shavua, and the daughter of Rav Chista came along and said to the Dayan, you shouldn't rely upon this person because this person is not reliable, not a reliable person. And as a result of that, so they switched the Shavua, that the person who was supposed to take the Shavua was not allowed to because not trusted to take the Shavua, and it was reversed so that the other party took the Shavua. The simple understanding of the Gemara is that it was reversed so that the other party now is allowed to take a Shavua and is allowed to collect money on as a result. Collecting money as a result, so that would seem to indicate that you are relying very much upon your own assessment of the circumstances, even when there are no two kosher eidim around. That's the Gemara in Ksuvos and Daf Pehei. So the case of Bas Rav Chisna, the relying upon her credibility, even though she's not a kosher eid at all, in order to prevent somebody from taking a Shavua. So this is an interesting, question. Are you really relying upon, circumstantial evidence in order to adjudicate a monetary claim? So one interpretation of the Gemara is, no, really, this aid, it was one of these cases where the Shavua was a Nishba Minotel type of Shavua, where the person would have been able to take a Shavua to collect money, like, for example, a laborer who can take a Shavua in order to collect their wages. And by reversing the Shavua, you weren't enabling somebody else to collect money, but only to be exempt from money. And this is the distinction which is drawn by the Nesivos HaMishpat. The Nesivos HaMishpat says that as a general rule, you can rely upon circumstantial evidence in order to exempt somebody for money, so that if they otherwise would have had to pay, we say we're not going to jump to judgment so quickly in order to extract money, but in order to actually issue a monetary judgment that somebody's going to have to pay money, so then we don't rely upon circumstantial evidence. And circumstantial evidence is not good enough, and that's the case of Gamala Oche Beta Gemalim, right, where we would have relied upon circumstantial evidence in order to make the owner of the wild camel have to pay damages to the owner of the camel that was killed. So that's another approach to distinguish between those two types of cases. So they ask on that as well. But what about the case of Rabbi Bana? Rabbi Bana is a case where you're actually handing over money to somebody, that you have 10 sons and only one of them is going to receive the Yerusha, and you're handing over money. It's actually concluding a monetary case of taking money from the estate and giving it to somebody on the basis of the circumstantial evidence. So therefore, these klalim seem to be arguably useful klalim, but they don't seem to be perfect klalim across the board. So here's where the Rush comes into the picture. The Rush says that really there are umdanus and there are umdanus. He says that as a general rule, you're supposed to rely upon the ironclad evidence and testimony of two kosher witnesses in order to decide even monetary cases, and you can't rely upon circumstantial evidence. But he says sometimes that's going to result in an injustice. It's going to result in an injustice. And he gives, there are two different gemaras that talk about if I have a din merumah, I have a din merumah, that a dayan is obligated to discharge a case, that a dayan is supposed to be done din emes la'amito, that he's supposed to be like decide a case la'amito in order to be a shuta of HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'maaseh bereishis. It's a very high level of judgment that's supposed to be executed by a Jewish law judge. So what does it mean, says the Gemara in Sanhedrin Dav Zayin, to be dayan din emes la'amito? So it means that you're supposed to avoid a din merumah. You're supposed to, what is a din merumah? That if you see that there's chicanery going on, there are witnesses who are testifying, and it would seem that the witnesses cannot be in any way challenged, they cannot be in any way impugned. Nonetheless, there's something fishy going on, that the judge sees that there's something fishy going on. So he is supposed to step away from the case. If, for example, the plaintiff brings the witnesses in order to recover money, and the judge feels there's something fishy going on, so he has to withdraw from the case, recuse himself, and say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to extract money on this basis. There's another Gemara that also indicates, that talks about Din Merumah. The other Gemara talks about Din Merumah in the context that the one who is being the Merumah is the Nitba. The Nitba, the one who is the defendant, is figuring out a good way to wheedle out of their obligations, making arguments that halakhically could be acceptable arguments, but the Dayan sees that there's something very fishy about the arguments of the defendant. Even though the Tobeya doesn't have ironclad aid them in order to, you know, prove their case, and therefore the Dayan is obligated here not to step away from the case, because why should the Nitba be rewarded by virtue of their chicanery? In this particular context, the Dayan is obligated to be Doresh Becholker, to work even harder than they would have had to work, you know, before, in order to impugn the integrity of the Nitba, of the defendant, so that the Tovea will be able to collect. And the Rush says, even if it's not at the end of the day going to be justified according to the strict letter of the law, this is the obligation of the Dayan to render judgment even based on umdanus, if that's the only way in which proper justice can be served. And the Rush, in the course of explaining the rationale for his determination, quotes all of these Gemaras, and he lumps them all together. He doesn't say, these are only Gemaras, the case of Mavrechus, in the case of the person who writes all their assets, when they're a Shkim Meirah, writes all the assets away to somebody else because they think that their son is dead and all that. That's only talking about, I'm assessing the Yumdana of Das. He doesn't distinguish between Das. He doesn't distinguish between Maseh. And the other very fascinating thing that the Rush does is that the Rush quotes Rabbi Acha almost as if Rabbi Acha is the halacha that we follow. He says, oh, and even Rabbi Acha says, if I have a gomel, it's ocheh ben a gemalim, and imsa gomel harug b'tzido, so we can extract money on that basis. And he doesn't say, oh, and by the way, the chachamim disagree. And he quotes from Shlomo HaMelech. He says, oh, and we see Shlomo HaMelech with the two zonos, right, the two women who came and claimed that a particular child was there. We see that he belied an umdana to see which one really cared the most about the child in order to render his decision. So he lumps everything all together in saying that sometimes a dayan is obligated to follow umdana. And he quotes the whole story of Rabbi Bono as well, the whole story of the man who only gave his assets to the one son who was legitimately his son without knowing which one that was. So all of these gemaras and precedents are marshaled by the Rosh to simply come to the conclusion that part of a dayan's job is to be able to render din emes la'amito, to be able to make sure that he does not turn away any case that comes into his jurisdiction without responsibly disposing of it in a fair and just fashion. And sometimes that's going to require a reliance upon umdunus. And the Rosh has a long discussion about some very interesting case where there was an outstanding debt that this fellow Reuven had against the Levi and Shimon, and Levi was trying to pay his portion of the debt. Shimon died, and Shimon left a wife and left some children, and the wife had this liability that she had inherited from her husband, both that the husband never paid up, and also some of her husband's debts had been paid up by Levi, and therefore she owed the Reuven, and she owed Levi, and she kept on asking for extensions. In the meantime, all of her children jumped town, and they all left town. And then at a certain point in time, the shtar got lost somehow, the shtar Reuven got lost, and there was a claim that her children or her family made that, oh, we paid up all of the money at once, and this is why there's no shtar anymore, and really we had received a receipt for all the money that was paid, and the receipt got lost. Some very suspicious and cockamamie story. And the Rosh said, this doesn't add up. Everybody had left town, and there's no way that they would have, you know, paid up without having it very, very clearly evidenced, given, you know, all of the debts, and they wouldn't have paid up at once when they kept on asking for extensions to pay such a large sum of months. And he said, because of the fact that this is so clearly a din meruma, and therefore they are not entitled to utilize the defense, even though strictly speaking, according to halacha, Reuven no longer had the shtar, and they would have been able to come up with a defense of parati that we already paid. But he said, here, parati doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make sense that they would have paid, and therefore he did not entitle them to get off the hook. This whole case of the Rosh, interestingly enough, is codified in Shulchan Aruch, meaning the Rosh had, you know, this conclusion. So you'll say, oh, maybe the Rosh really paskin like Rabbi Acha. So since the Rosh really paskin like Rabbi Acha, we don't paskin like Rabbi Acha, so therefore we're not going to go along with the Rosh's conclusion in this case. But the Shulchan Aruch goes along with the Rosh's conclusion in this case. So it's a contradiction there.
Why don't we say that then Amos Lamito requires Din Meruma? I mean, if you have a Din Meruma, if you see it, blood dripping from the sword, why doesn't Bezin say, sorry, we're going to have to condemn you. We're not going to let you go free. It's going to be a miscarriage of justice. Well, how does he explain the Gemara in Shavuos?
I'll give you a possible explanation, okay? I'll give you a possible explanation.
He hasn't mentioned the Gemara.
Shimon ben Shattach is one case, right? That's a Dinei Nefashos case, and it seems like the most egregious example you can come up with. But let's say I gave you another example that wasn't quite Dinei Nefashos. It was a tort case. Gemara in Shavuos and Daf Mem Vav. Somebody walks into a person's home, okay? This person is 100% healthy, and then he walks into a fellow, Reuven walks into Shimon's home, and the only one home is Shimon. You know, we did a check beforehand, like you're doing a yichud room. There's nobody there except for Shimon. Shimon's the only one in the home. Reuven leaves the home, and he has this giant wound in his back in a location where there's no way he could have self-inflicted the wound on his back. There's no way that it could have been inflicted by anybody or anything other than a human being. And the only one who could have possibly inflicted the wound was Shimon. So the Gemara says Shimon is obligated to pay. Ah, there were no edim that saw this. How is Shimon obligated to pay? So Tosfos says over there, because of the fact that there were umdenus and there were umdenus, sometimes I have a pretty clear idea of something that happened, but I can't say 100% conclusively. He says here, there's no other explanation. Even though there are no witnesses, there's no other explanation. And when you have an umdena, which is as clear-cut as this, it's almost as if you have a yediyah brewer. It's almost like what we would call an anansadius. As if there were witnesses present, because there's no other possible explanation. And says Tosfos, this would even be good for Dinei Nefashos. This is better than the Shimon ben Shetach case. The Shimon ben Shetach case, so, you know, maybe somebody else could have, you know, killed this individual. I don't know exactly how. It's a chorba. But he says, oh, maybe he could have plunged the knife into, you know, himself. Maybe it wasn't in a place in the back, you know, where somebody else would have had to do it. Some sort of an explanation, but this would work even in Dinei Nefashos. Comes along the Yad Ramah. Yad Ramah and Sanhedrin Daf, Tosfos is in Shuas Daf Lamed Daled. The Yad Ramah and Sanhedrin Daf Lamed Zayin comes along and says, nothing doing. It could be that if I have a case which is incredibly compelling circumstantial evidence in the realm of mominous, so then I'm going to rely upon it. But in Nefashos, absolutely not. Nefashos is a totally different category, because you cannot really meaningfully distinguish between the Shimon ben Shetach case and this case of the person who walks into somebody's home where there were only two people around, and he walks out and he has a gaping wound on his back. The two cases are too close to each other. If it doesn't work in the Shimon ben Shetach case to convict somebody for murder, so you're not going to be able to convict somebody of murder in this case either. And this is only something that could potentially work in the realm of Dinei Mamonos. So a possible answer to your question is, maybe we follow the Yad Ramah, that there's some sort of a distinction that we would draw between Dinei Mamonos and Dinei Nefashos. And when the Rosh quoted from Rabbi Acha, he didn't mean to say necessarily that we really paskin like Rabbi Acha in the case of Gamal or Ocher Ben HaGamal. And maybe we don't paskin like Rabbi, even the Rosh would agree that we don't paskin. But it means that there's, from the discussion between Rabbi Acha and the Chachamim, maybe they're not arguing so much in terms of the Metzias. What I mean by Metzias? They're not arguing so much in terms of the Metzias as to whether you could convict in a Dinei Mamonos case when there is strong circumstantial evidence, but they're arguing about the shear. They're arguing about what is considered to be strong enough circumstantial evidence in order to impose liability in a monetary case. And from Rabbi Acha, you can learn to the Chachamim that even the Chachamim would have some sort of a threshold. And what's that threshold? So we find that threshold in the Gemara in Shmuas. The Gemara in Shmuas tells us that if the threshold is the limit approaching, you know, an absolute certainty, right? Think of a calculus equation, that it is, you know, based on the circumstances, it's pretty much a near certainty. We wouldn't accept it in a murder case, but we would accept it in a non-murder, non-capital case, where the person could not have received the wound. Reuven couldn't have received the wound unless Shimon had inflicted it, even though there were no edim that saw it. So in such a case, then we can can render a monetary judgment in a non-capital case in favor of the victim based on extremely compelling circumstantial evidence. And the one who seems to also open the door for this possible distinction is the Rambam. The Rambam, in his Sefer HaMitzvos, in Mitzvos Lo Sa'aseh, Reish Tzadi, gives you the conceptual explanation as to why it is that we don't rely upon circumstantial evidence, and he's talking purely in a Dinei Nefashos context, the Rambam. And in the Dinei Nefashos context, the Rambam says that it's based on Gzeiras HaKosav, an Akivit Tzadik Al Tarog, that you're not allowed to kill somebody who is a Naki or a Tzadik. Now, Naki or Tzadik doesn't always mean that the person is completely innocent, right? It could be the person is a tzaddik in the sense that he came out of Beis Din innocent because they rendered a favorable, not guilty verdict in his case. And then afterwards, there are eidim to come along and say, wait a second, but I have testimony or I have evidence that this person really is guilty. Afterwards, we say, no, tzaddik al tarog, once we made him into a quote-unquote tzaddik, then we're not going to be able to convict him again. So the Rambam says there's a public policy consideration at play over here. He says that if we're ever going to allow anything less in a capital case than two impeccable edim who actually witnessed the maaseh of a murder that was committed, the capital offense that was committed, and we're going to start relying upon circumstantial evidence, no matter how compelling, like in a Shimon ben Shetach type scenario, you have at least a slight possibility of making a mistake. And even if you get it correct 999 times, if the 1,000th time you're not going to get it correct, so from a public policy perspective, we don't want to have a system where 1 out of 1,000 of the murder convicts are going to be really innocent, and you're going to put an innocent man to death. And therefore, that's why the Torah has this principle, Menachiv Tzadik Al Tarov, that you have to rely on nothing less than two valid witnesses who actually saw the act of murder in order to put a murder defendant to death. This is sacrosanct in the Dinei Nefashos realm. So Ramban, in his commentary to the Sefer HaMitzvos, in his Hasagos to the Sefer HaMitzvos, the Ramban says, this is nice, there he goes again, right? You know, there goes the Ramban making up his own drashos. I looked at my version of the Shas. I don't have this drasha from Natsik Benakivet Tzadik Atarog. I have a discussion about how you can't rely on umdunus. It's true. You're not supposed to rely on umdunus in Dine Nefashos. You're not supposed to rely on umdunus in Dine Mamunus. But I don't find the special Xeris or Kosuv anywhere when it comes to not relying upon umdunus. I only find this pasuk Benakivet Tzadik Atarog in the context of what we just discussed. I have a murder defendant. I have a defendant in a capital case who was exculpated who was vindicated by the Beis Din, by the Sanhedrin, or by the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin Katana, and he leaves Beis Din innocent, so I can't bring him back to retry him. Or he came out guilty, and I now have evidence that would exonerate him, so then I have to reconsider the evidence in order to exonerate him. So I learned that out from Ben Akivet Tzadik Al Tarok. I don't learn this other principle out from Ben Akivet Tzadik Al Tarok. So he says, so where did it all come from? So we can answer, the Rambam is coming up with some sort of Xeris HaKosu because he has to explain the svara behind a distinction. A distinction between Dinei Nefashos on the one hand and Dinei Mamonos on the other hand. Like the Yad Mamah says, that there is room to say that even if we're going to rely on really compelling circumstantial evidence of Dinei Mamonos, it doesn't mean that we're going to rely upon it with respect to Dinei Nefashos. So this is the explanation. The Rama may be explaining it conceptually because he throws in this public policy consideration, but he also brings a pasuk to boot, right? And this is also similar to a Gemara relates to one of the other rayas that was brought by the Rosh. So the Rosh brought a raya from Shlomo HaMelech, right? So he brought the raya from Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech case sounds a little bit like it's in the realm of Dinei Nefashos. I mean, I was talking about cutting the baby in half a little bit, right? That's certainly awarding, you know, a child to one of the two mothers is a serious and critical decision that you know borders on the realm of Dinei Nefashos. So the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Chof Aleph Amud Beis. I asked my son to retrieve from me before. I think he found me a Gemara here. It says Ratsa that the Shlomo HaMelech wanted Lasos B'liyedim V'liyrayos. He wanted to be able to judge cases without witnesses and without ironclad evidence. Sound familiar? In other words, he wanted to decide cases based on umdunus. Why not? He's Shlomo HaMelech, smartest man in the world. If anybody could do it, it's Shlomo HaMelech, right? So he wanted to be able to adjudicate cases in this fashion, B'liyedim V'liyrayos, Elish above Baskol. But a Baskol came out from heaven. Baskol came out from heaven. What did this Baskol, this voice from heaven, what did it say to Shlomo HaMelech? So this Baskol said to Shlomo HaMelech, Api Yishnayim Edim, it says you have to adjudicate Api Yishnayim Edim. You're only allowed to decide cases according to Shnayim Edim. So what is, we have two different psukim in the Torah. That have this notion that I require two witnesses. One of them says Api Shnayim Edim, one of them says Api Shnei Edim, right? Which is the pasuk that says Api Shnayim? One of them says Yokum Dover. That's talking about matters even in a monetary sphere, right? One of them says Yuma Sameis. Which one is Shnayim? Which one, who knows their, you know, who knows their Tanakh over here, okay? Or Hamisha Chum Shei Torah, who's a Baal Kriya. So it says, Api Shnayim Edim, Yuma Sameis. The Baskor that came out was telling him the Pasuk, Api Shnayim Edim, Yuma Sameis. You want to decide based on umdunus? Don't do it in capital cases. So this could be another possible source if we're looking for a pasuk. I didn't see anyone quote this one, but this could be a possible source as well. The Gemara Makos said that's the voice that he heard. He heard the voice of Api Shnai Emedim.
How about Ein Mashkichim Lebasko?
I'm sorry?
Ein Mashkichim Lebasko? We don't talk Lo Bashamayim Hi? I mean...
Okay, he was reminding him of a pasuk. That's all. He's reminding him of a pasuk. At the end of the day, he's possibly based on the pasuk.
Yeah, but we're trying to learn from
the pasuk. He's being reminded about what the pasuk is. That's, that's not a problem, as long as at the end of the day, you're relying upon the pasuk. Now, it's a kind of interesting because the Gemara in Makos also talks about the Shlomo HaMelech, you know, perhaps relying upon Umdenus, that it's saying that there were various points in history in which a Ruach HaKodesh came out in order to help people adjudicate something. And one example that's given is the Ruach HaKodesh Yatzel Shlomo HaMelech in the case of the Beis Zonos. Totally independent, separate Gemara. Yeah. Then the Gemara says, no, maybe it wasn't really Ruach HaKodesh that was guiding Shlomo HaMelech. Maybe it was Umdana. Maybe he was deciding based on Umdana. So here's the question. Did he have a right to decide based on Umdana? So it depends. Maybe this Gemara is saying, well, ultimately he wasn't deciding a case, a capital case. He wasn't really going to split the baby in half. Maybe that really was a non-capital case, and he could have relied upon Umdana. But how do I know that he was really relying upon Ruach HaKodesh? So the Gemara says at the end that it was Gemara Habe, that we have a tradition that he decided that case, that it wasn't an inspired decision on his own to decide the case according to the Umdana. It was rather based on Ruach HaKodesh. So I can understand that in one or two different ways. I could say he didn't have the right to decide the case according to Umdana. I could say, no, maybe as long as he wasn't being done in the Fashis, he could have decided the case based on Umdana, and that's why the Gemara brings that as a suggestion, but then at the end says, no, we have a tradition that it wasn't based on Umdana. So if you take a look at the Shulchan Aruch, so what do we have here? So now we have three different approaches of how we can understand the Gemaras that seem to indicate you can't rely on Umdana, and those that say that you can rely on Umdana. So one approach that we mentioned is that you can rely upon Umdana if it's to determine what happened, right? Even in a monetary case, but you can rely on it if it's to determine a person's state of mind. That was the approach of the Ma'arik. Then we have the second approach, which is the approach of the Nesivos HaMishpat, who says, well, it depends on whether I'm being Maksik Mammon or whether I'm being Motzi Mammon. Being Motzi Mammon, I can't rely upon Umdanus. I'm being Maksik Mammon, person to keep their money, so then I can rely upon Umdanus. It's a different question as to how I understand that whole Gemara and Ksuvah Staf Pehei regarding Basvav Chista. Then I have a third approach, which is to say that maybe I can rely upon Umdanus if they're incredibly compelling Umdanus, meaning that there's regular circumstantial evidence where it's more probable than not that something occurred, and then there's circumstantial evidence where it's almost certainly the case that something occurred. I can't say 100% certainly the case, but almost certainly the case that something occurred. And maybe beyond a reasonable doubt, if you wanted to use, you know, some other frame of reference, not that it's the exact same standard necessarily, but think of it in those terms. So if I have this higher threshold level, so then I would be able to rely on Umdanus even to be Motzi Mammon in monetary cases, but even within that realm, it's still possible that I would distinguish between monetary cases and capital cases to say that it's only going to work in the monetary realm, but it's not going to work with respect to capital cases. Very interesting as well, there's a fourth approach of Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi. Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi says, you know, umdanus are really something which are very dangerous. You put umdanus in the wrong hands. You tell somebody that you can decide cases even if you don't have perfect evidence. So you have like a corrupt, you know, law official or something that's going to take advantage of that rule, and they may really abuse it in ways that will be a complete travesty and perversion of justice rather than a perpetration of justice. So therefore, for that reason, it says that the Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi that there are times that the Gemara indicates that we can rely upon Umdanus and we can bring all of these cases of Shtam of Rechis, of Ishchim Meira, of Akosim Nechasiv La'achayim Kishishama Shem Meislo Bino, and all of the cases that are mentioned in the Gemara, and we can simply say we're going to draw the line. We're going to say that it's we are not smart enough to decide on different types of Umdana that go beyond that which the Chachmei HaGemara were comfortable with. So any umnura that the Gemara says that we are entitled to rely upon, so we will rely upon those umnuras, even if it means that we're going to be motzi mamon. But anything which is not explicitly mentioned in the Gemara as a type of umnura that you could rely upon, so that we're not going to rely upon. So that's kind of like another approach that just is sort of the historically cautious approach to say, okay, we have, you know, we've been able to somehow tear away at the general proposition that apishnayim eidim, apishnei eidim yakum davar, but the tearing away of this principle has to be circumscribed according to the parameters that were established by Chazal. Now let's turn to Shulchan Aruch for a second and see how this all plays out in Shulchan Aruch. So I mentioned the Rosh. So the Rosh, when I said that he conflated the idea of umdano with Pshara, so since the Rosh's presentation is Torah Mate Aleh, or Din Torah Mate Aleh, what's going to happen if judges just reject cases because they don't have sufficient evidence according to the Torah rules, and therefore they're going to allow injustices to be perpetrated, so that wouldn't be fair either. So he brings as examples, he says that it's the same idea with respect to certain cases where based on not really being able to know whether the right result is A or B, or two people have equal rights to something, like the case the Gemara had talks about the two boats that both have to pass a narrow opening in the water, so you have to sometimes be hatil pshara b'neihem. Sometimes the din is that you got to make a pshara. The din is that I'm not going to be able to decide the case if two people have equal rights, but I got to make one person go first. So then I got to think, okay, which one is it is more needy than the other one? Which one came first before the other one? I have to come up with some sort of a pshara determination just so the din will work, because according to the Rosh, this is all hainuhach. It's all the same sort of idea that a dayan can't turn away any case without making some sort of a judicious determination based on the totality of the circumstances. So how does it all get codified? Most of it is codified in the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Tes Vav. It's very interesting because it's almost verbatim out of the Rosh. You know, most halachos seem to have a basis in a Gemara. Maybe it's a Gemara which is fleshed out by various Rishonim in terms of their interpretation of the Gemara. But sometimes the Shulchan Aruch will just bring entire dinim, and there'll be even lengthy dinim, that will be straight out of a tshuva. Be straight out of a tshuva, that's really almost the next level beyond the Gemara formulation. And that's really what happens over here. Here in Siman Tes Vav, from Sif Gimel to Sif Hei, I have three different paragraphs in the Shulchan Aruch that really are all about how the Rosh disposes with this very important conundrum of what do Dayanim do nowadays when faced with a situation in which they don't have the perfect forms of evidence and testimony that are described in the Gemara. So Sif Gimel says, Hadayan Shabbal Afanim Din Shiodea Shemaruma. First we talk about the case where the Dayan knows that there's something suspect about a certain judicial presentation. He sees that the Tobea, the plaintiff, the claimant, is bringing witnesses who are suspicious. Now, they're testifying, and their testimony, if you would just take it at face value, would be enough in order for the plaintiff to prevail upon his claim. But the Dayan sees there's something fishy here. So he says that the Dayan has to up the ante in terms of trying to impugn the Edom when he sees that there's something wrong with the Edom. In Nira Lo, She'eish Bo Ramos, if he sees that there is some chicanery, even though he can't invalidate the witnesses, or he comes to the conclusion that this litigant is dishonest, and is somebody who is a trickster and is a charlatan, and that somehow he maneuvered and manipulated the witnesses, even though the witnesses themselves may not be invalid witnesses. Or he sees that there are things that are not being revealed completely. So in this case, where the one who is the charlatan is the plaintiff, so then the only solution is for the dayan to refuse to hand down the judgment. Because if he would hand down the judgment, it would be in favor of the plaintiff on the basis of the witness. He says, I'm sorry, I feel like it's not sufficient. It's true, according to the black letter law, it should be sufficient, I just can't do it. El Yisari Gatsum Vidinze. I'm sorry, but this is going to have to be a mistrial of sorts. A mistrial? I just can't do it. I can't posken it. I'm not going to be a party. I'm not going to be complicit to this miscarriage of justice. Verei hadvar misumim beled. And what's interesting, this is rare for the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch quotes a Rishon. In the Shulchan Aruch, he actually quotes the Rishon. He says, and you're probably wondering where I'm getting all of this from. It doesn't sound like any Gemara that you learn. It's a rush. But this rush is a really important rush. The Shulchan Aruch says, "Ukshahaya roeh harush." When the rush would see, he would see that it was that there were compelling. Sorry, there was compelling circumstantial evidence that a din was suspicious. So he would write to the defendant that this case not only is it a mistrial, but it should never be tried again. It should never be tried again. That would be that this case should simply be dismissed. It should go away, even though it can't really be dismissed on the merits. But that again is when the plaintiff is the problematic personality. What about when the defendant is the problematic personality? Because those are really the cases that the Rush was dealing with cases where the defendants had on the surface a legitimate claim of operati, I paid this already, but it just did not seem plausible that they would have paid something. It says, if it's the nipa that is the one who appears to be the fraudster, it's not fair to make the defendant win because of the fact that the dayan feels, I can't decide the case. So therefore, the nipa is going to, I'm going to be mistalik from the case. I'm going to say, this case can't be decided. What happens if the case can't be decided? The defendant wins, right? Because then he doesn't have to pay. That doesn't work. Rather, he has to plug away the vata ramu uso in order to get to the heart of the matter. And if the dayan comes to the conclusion that the circumstantial evidence is so compelling that the tobeya is probably in the right, even though he does not have the witnesses and the testimony that would be strictly required according to Torah law, and Mudayan, then he has the right to obligate the person to pay. Now here, the question is, what is the level of a Bezdin that has the right to make this determination? So he adds the words, and these are problematic words for a Bezdin that has any sense of humility whatsoever. I hope we have some sense of humility. It says, Imhudayan mumche v'yachid b'dol. If we're talking about a top-notch crackerjack dayan, who's a yachid b'dol, who's like the greatest dayan of his generation. Now, who's going to make the assertion that they're the greatest dayan of their generation, right? Now, if you look in the Piskei Tshuva, so Piskei Tshuva quotes from the Avodas Hagirshuni, and he says that it's very difficult to require this standard. And he says, V'adarabah, says he thinks that Akshav Yota Yeshla Dladin Apia Umad. He thinks that not only is it the case that we shouldn't say that Hayamim Arishonim Ayu Tovim Me'ela, that only the original Dayanim could have done this. He says, no. He says that there's more of a need for us to decide in this way, Apia Omen Ve'ayosher, according to compelling circumstantial evidence and based on equitable considerations, because let's get now to the Pshara realm. Because we had said, and this is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch at the end of a Siman Yud Beis, the dayanim are supposed to avoid deciding according to the strict letter of law, because who says that we are on the level that we know how to do that properly? So he says that once, and this is where the worlds collide or the worlds merge in some symbiotic fashion, between the world of Umdener and the world of Pshara. He says, given where this we're supposed to decide cases according to Pshara, so therefore it makes it more feasible to bring Umdener into the judgment process. Every dayan has the right and even the responsibility to decide the case according to the omer, according to his own assessment of the realities of the case. To make a pshara, the hafik a shvua, to have the shvua being made by a different party who otherwise would have made it. To make sure that it's all for the sake of heaven. Okay, good. I wanted to read one more halacha. All right, before we conclude, we have 2 minutes. All right, good. Last halacha, which is hey. And this is the sort of catch-all halacha, and this catch-all halacha is really coming from the Rambam himself. Yesh l'dayin l'adun l'dine mamonos apia dvarim shedaita nota lehem. The Rambam says this, that really the dayin, when it comes to dine mamonos, the idea of the two edim dine mamonos is the Rambam really serves a different function from two edim and two dine nefashos. Dine nefashos is an absolute requirement. Dine mamonos, it just means that once you have to weigh them, so all other bets are off. The Rush would say not necessarily, if you think that there's something fishy going on. But of course, in dine mamonos, if you have other ways of coming to a judgment, says the Rambam, you have now responsibility to do so. The only thing that the Rambam adds is that once Misharabu Bati Dim Shayna Magunim, when there was an abundance of Bati Din that weren't so perfect, so then they were told and they were admonished that they should not rely upon Umdanus, Afbishadaito Samechis al Divrayim, because you need a Dayan who can be trusted to act in with absolute integrity when it comes to these types of determinations. What is the basis for saying that otherwise there would be a right for a Dayan to decide in accordance with what is just and fair under the circumstances? So here is where the Vilna Gaon actually quotes, and he quotes from the case of Shlomo, and he quotes from the case of Baba Basa with Rabbi Bana, and he quotes from the Maisa Hazonos Lifnei Shlomo, so we see that it actually ends up being incorporated in some measure, right? In some measure, as long as it is being decided in a case of Dine Mamonos, as opposed to a case of Dine Nefashos. You look in the Aruch HaShulchan. Aruch HaShulchan says as well that while we have to be careful not to abuse this principle of deciding in accordance with Umdanus, nonetheless, it also is something that a dayan should not refrain from entirely either, because of the fact that if you refuse to take into account circumstantial evidence and you insist only upon two kasher edim, then there are many cases in which fairness and justice will not otherwise be performed, because if you are going to be a stickler for those principles and for those standards. So therefore, in order to ensure the proper administration of justice, you have to, and also the proper administration of pshara, which is what we generally decide according to nowadays, you have to be able to take into account umdana considerations, but obviously you have to do it with the proper degree of responsibility.
Can either one of the Balei Dinim insist, no, I don't want pshara, I want din? Can either one of the Balei Dinim, in order to have pshara, do you have to have both Balei Dinim?
It's a machlokas. It's a machlokas.
Because you don't have two Eidim, then the Balei Dinim that says, hey, you don't have two Eidim, I insist on din. I'm not going to go with pshara. Then you can't. You have to go with only Shnayim Eidim.
Technically speaking, the Balei Dinim have either Balei Dinim has the right to insist on din.
All right.
However, many poskim nowadays say, but incorporated in the Shulchan Aruch, which is what's din, is that the dayanim are not allowed to decide according to strict din. So now strict din means that you have to decide according to pshara.
Which allows litigants to agree in writing to accept the pshara.
Yes, and pretty much every single
arbitration.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yes, part of the arbitration.
I'm going to try that.
Okay,
I'm going to try that.
If
I have any questions,
but can you get a C-rate?
Okay, yes.
If you say, no, I don't want to, I want din only. Can you get a C-rate?
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Could there be a distinction between Dine Mamonos and